you are always getting paid. And you are always getting paid in the currency you are asking for. So maybe the currency you're asking for is likes on Facebook. Or maybe the currency you're asking for is a lot of compliments from your friends. Or maybe the currency you're asking for is neglect. You know, for a long time, my self-esteem was so low, it sort of mattered to me that I work really hard and kind of have no one notice. Like, that kind of worked for me in a weird way. And when I started the Organized Artist Company, you know, I started building my list very organically and had this wonderful list of people who were really responsive, and they'd write me back and they would click and like and everything, but they never bought anything. And finally, I realized, oh, wait, I think the problem is me. And I realized, yeah, because I was more invested in their affection than I was in making a living. And the minute I decided, oh, wait, I think it's possible for me to have their affection and make a living, you know, I tripled my income.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by HostGator. So I've said before in other episodes that everyone should learn to build a website. There's probably not a job application that you'll ever fill out where there's not an option to enter a URL for your website. And it's a skill that will always come in handy, and it doesn't have to be incredibly complicated. It can be something as simple as a picture and a short bio about you. And HostGator is fantastic for helping you to get started because they're providing 24/7 live support via phone chat and email. They have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, and one-click WordPress installs if you really want to get your hands dirty. And they make it super simple to switch from an existing host if you don't like your existing hosting provider. And they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Today's episode is also brought to you by The Ultimate Game of Life. So my business partner, Brian, and I went through this course last year, and we found it so valuable that not only are we doing it again to start off 2017, but we're having our new hires go through it as well. You've probably read a little bit about this if you're on our email newsletter. Play The Ultimate Game of Life, and you'll see measurable results in three foundational areas: your health, your wealth, and your happiness. Sign up for their exclusive free seminar by visiting unmistakablecreative.com/tug. That's unmistakablecreative.com/TUG. Sam, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much, Trini. Hi, everybody.
Yeah, it is really cool to have you back here a second time because, you know, we had you when you had your previous book come out, Get It Done, which, you know, I loved that book because it was incredibly simple and incredibly applicable. And it wasn't all sorts of crazy things that involved taking gargantuan risks, but things anybody who is a creative professional could do on a daily basis to actually make progress. And, you know, the second book, which is why you're back, Start Right Where You Are, also I felt had a lot of the same tone to it. But before we get into the ideas from the book, I want to ask you, what did your parents do for a living, and how did that impact the choices that you've made with your life and your career?
That's so interesting. Okay, so my both of my parents came from a fair amount of family money. As a novel I read once said, my family money's so old there's none left. And so there's been very little trickle-down effect from this. But my parents themselves grew up in very affluent environments. And so my dad, mostly he golfed. He was one of actually America's best amateur golfers for a long time. And he had some, when I was little, he sold time for a radio station. And then I'm not sure what he was doing. And then he worked for his family business for a while, Bennett Box and Pallet Company, which made boxes and pallets to ship ammunition in and pallets for forklifts. And then he kind of didn't do very much. And then he sort of like did investment advising and insurance sales and stuff. And but he was really severely depressed for most of his life and kind of only got diagnosed and treated fairly recently. So it was really hard for him. He wasn't really into the whole holding down a job thing. Mm-hmm. And my mom was always kind of an entrepreneur. She had a marketing communications business when I was a girl. She opened her own yoga studio. She was a yoga student and studied with BKS Iyengar in India. And So ran a yoga studio back when everybody thought yoga was, you know, I don't know, a cult or something. And now she has a business called the International Institute for Facilitation and Change, where she works with mostly nonprofits and NGOs in Central and South America, helping them have better meetings, actually better agenda planning and better meetings. So the fact that neither of them ever had like a traditional get up in the morning and go to work kind of a job, I think definitely influenced my view of work and that they were both kind of their own boss all the time. My parents divorced when I was very young and then proceeded to marry and divorce everybody else. Mm-hmm. So like I have more ex-step parents than most people have toes. so there was a lot about my growing up that was kind of unconventional. But I think the idea that you could, that your work could be an extension of your intellectual curiosity, you know, that work was something that, nourished you and was interesting and was kind of a force for good in the world, that that definitely hit me big time.
To parents who are listening to this, who maybe have, you know, the get up and go to work job, I mean, what do you think that they should be telling their kids about work, having had the upbringing that you've had?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was such a weird kid. I was an actor before I even knew that there was such a thing as being an actor professionally. You know, I always wanted to be an actor. And sometimes people ask like, oh, you know, were your parents supportive? It's like, I don't know that they ever felt like they even had a choice about supporting me in being an actor. Like that's all I ever wanted to do. And I was so clear about that, that they were, you know, they kind of went along for the ride. So I guess that's what I would say, is whatever it is that your kids are super duper into, whatever it is that's really sparking their curiosity and making them want to get up and do things, you know, like, oh, I've got to go see this show, or I've got to take this class, or I've got to go to this theater camp, or I've got to go, you know, to really support them in that, because no matter how impractical it looks from the outside, it will lead them to where they need to go. You know, the skills you learn as an actor are invaluable in life and certainly in entrepreneurship. And I imagine that would have been true if I'd been into chess or, you know, debate or building robots or whatever, you know.
Hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because I think that we have this very strange sort of narrative of putting pressure on people at an age when they're incredibly young to figure out what it is that they want to do with their life. And it becomes this huge source of stress and anxiety. And, you know, I at moments try to think back about why I couldn't make more intelligent career decisions early in my career. And I realized that the problem with this notion that you have to know what you're going to do with your life at the age of 20, 25, 18 is you don't have enough data points to make a really informed decision. It's a very narrow perspective that causes the decisions that you make.
Yeah. 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 And you don't even really know what your skill sets are. You know, you don't really know what you're great at. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think really just, you know, almost the kind of, if you can sort of broaden out the idea behind Montessori, you know, really let kids follow their own interests and go where they want to go. Cause really it'll add up to something. It absolutely will. Don't worry.
Mm. So having had parents who, it came from affluence, I'm curious kind of what your own sort of money story was growing up, having seen parents like that, and, you know, how has it evolved? Because I know you talked about this a little bit in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the real benefit to the way I grew up is that, I'm not afraid of money, you know, like, and I never had an idea that money was bad or that rich people were bad and, or rich people are snobby or rich people aren't nice. You know, I never felt that way. And my mother especially was always very clear about sort of what money could buy. I mean, it could buy us theater tickets. It could buy us, you know, me going to theater camp. It could, you know, going to a great school, but we were never into like expensive cars or fancy trips or, you know, probably we didn't have that much money, but also, you know, we just, that wasn't our thing. It just, we just weren't into that. So I think it growing up with a lack of fear around money and a real clarity around what money can buy and what it couldn't. I also, and I, this, I don't know what prompted my parents to do this, but when I was 12, we moved into, my mother and my sister and I and whoever her husband was at the time, moved into a 3.5 flat in Chicago. So they had the first floor apartment and I had the basement apartment, and then the top two floors were for other families. So I had my own apartment that was connected to the main apartment, but I was starting at the age of 12, and I got I got $250 a quarter for allowance. So, and I was responsible for buying all my own books and my own toiletries, my own clothes and my own whatever I wanted. And I had to manage that money over the course of the quarter. And I got a job right away. Like I worked in retail. I had a job at a retail store in Chicago. So I was always very, very aware of money and I always had a job. And then I was so super broke as an actor for so long. I got really good at being really, really poor.
Yeah, I was going to ask about sort of, you know, having been in the situation that you did growing up, I knew the actor piece involves being poor for an extended period of time. It's funny because I have an old roommate who gave up a very high profile finance job, you know, at an investment firm where I remember he would spend, you know, $1,000 in a day without batting an eyelash. And he came to LA to be an actor and he's been at it for about 10 years. So I'm just curious kind of, you know, how does that... So how does the transition from being in a situation where money is not such a struggle to being in a situation where it is, like, how does that change things?
Well, I was really proud of my ability to live on very little money and proud of my ability to cobble together. You know, I was working the gig economy way before it was the gig economy. Like, you know, I had a million different part-time jobs and gigs and shows and projects and whatever. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it never felt like I personally had a lot of money. So, you know, the family money was always there, and maybe that gave me a certain confidence. Maybe that gave me a feeling of like, there's a safety net there, or there's, you know, there is an abundance of money somewhere. It may not be in my wallet right now, but it's out there. And a sense that I could afford to, not make very much money. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I mean, the reason I'm asking all these questions, obviously they're for personal morbid curiosity, but, Seth Godin had a really interesting sort of monologue in his Leap First seminar where he said, first and foremost, money is a story, and I'll prove to you it's a story. He said, it's a story for investment bankers who make $3 a second, and it's a story for peasants who make $3 a day. And that, you know, if you win the lottery, your life won't change substantially because your narrative around money is pretty much still the same.
That's 100% true. That's 100% true. And it's one of the reasons I love entrepreneurship, is because it is the single best tool for personal growth and spiritual development of all time, because everything that's going on in your head shows itself in your results. So whatever, wherever it is that you're screwed up around money, it will show, you can tell, because it's what's happening on your bank balance. It's what's happening right in front of you. And the minute you get out the tiny screwdrivers and fix what's going on inside of you, your results change instantaneously.
Okay, so
it's shocking.
Two questions will come from this. One is more of a comment than anything. You know, I realize that I absolutely despise putting IKEA furniture together because there are always parts left over and, you know, shelves start falling off like months later and it's just a total shit show. And then I realized I hate putting together furniture of all kinds, and I just moved into a new apartment and I thought to myself, okay, I wonder how much it would cost to have somebody come over and do this on TaskRabbit. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, I paid, I think, $60 for an hour and a half's worth of work that would have taken me like 8 or 9 hours.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is, there is a time in my life when I would not have done it specifically to save the $60, as opposed to the peace of mind that I get from having finished all of that, like having somebody else do it. So to me, that's a clear indication that mentally there's a shift that has been made of some sort. But I think the bigger question really that's probably on people's mind is, how do you change it? You know?
Well, the one thing to notice, or one thing that I was really pleased when I noticed it, I don't know, is that you are always getting paid. And you are always getting paid in the currency you are asking for. So maybe the currency you're asking for is likes on Facebook. Or maybe the currency you're asking for is a lot of compliments from your friends. Or maybe the currency you're asking for is neglect. You know, for a long time, my self-esteem was so low, it sort of mattered to me that I work really hard and kind of have no one notice. Like, that kind of worked for me in a weird way. And when I started the Organized Artist Company, you know, I started building my list very organically and had this wonderful list of people who were really responsive, and they'd write me back and they would click and like and everything, but they never bought anything. And finally, I realized, oh, wait, I think the problem is me. And I realized, yeah, because I was more invested in their affection than I was in making a living. And the minute I decided, oh, wait, I think it's possible for me to have their affection and make a living, you know, I tripled my income.
Hmm. Wow. Well, I think that makes a really perfect segue to start talking about some of the ideas in the book, one of which is the one that you just mentioned that really struck a chord with me. I know where I want to start with this. You mentioned that there are a lot of things that you learn as an actor that are incredibly useful for entrepreneurship and life in general, and I'm curious what those are.
Yeah, well, I think it was actually Seth that I heard say this, or maybe it was Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know, one of my heroes. Anything you can do that where you learn to stand up in front of people and speak coherently, and anything that you can do to improve yourself as a writer, if you can speak and write, you can pretty much always have a job doing pretty much whatever you want. The ability to communicate effectively with other human beings is just everything. I think the deep understanding of story is really, really important. And it's certainly what acting's all about, is telling stories. And it's what marketing is all about. You know, it's one of the reasons why I love marketing almost as much as I love acting, is because it's all about human behavior. Like, why do people do what they do? You know, what motivates them? What unmotivates them? Why do they say they'll do something and then they do something else? Or they say they'll never do something, but then they do it. It's fascinating to me. So that's a big part of it. So story, writing, speaking, story, ensemble, the ability to work with a group of people, some of whom have very strong personalities. That's a critical life skill. The ability to just keep going and do it no matter what. I mean, opening day is opening day. And I don't care if your cat died or if you've got the flu or your scene partner still doesn't know their lines or has bad breath. You know, like, you just have to do it. And that kind of grit and determination and see it through-ness, I think, is also a tremendous skill set. Understanding a little bit of stage magic, you know, of the energy in a room, how to read the energy in a room and how to manage the energy of a room when you're teaching or running a live event, or even, you know, even teaching online. Like, you're still together in a kind of a psychic room, and cultivating your intuition, huge, huge. Understanding what it is that makes you interesting or special, your sort of personal branding aspects. Oh my gosh. I mean, there's nothing about it that isn't applicable. Except maybe accents, space work, you know, mime.
So tell me what planted the seed for the second book.
Well, the second book is almost a prequel to the first book. You know, Get It Done is kind of project management for artists. You know, it's how do you get your work out into the world in a way that feels fun. So scheduling and budgeting and decision making and project management. But I realized, you know, if it's not actually okay with you on the inside that you get your work out into the world, or if you are so exhausted and stressed out that you can't even think about getting your creative work out into the world, it doesn't matter what clever strategies I give you, because you're not going to do it. And I realized I was also leaving out a big part of my own story, you know, that what had gotten me from broke and crying on a couch in North Hollywood to six figures by the beach was a lot of mindset stuff. It wasn't really the exercises and strategies, although those things helped. It was really the decisions that I learned how to make in the moment and the toolkit that I assembled to get me out of depression and out of being broke and into something a lot more fulfilling.
Okay, so you brought up depression, so I want to kind of talk briefly about that. I mean, one, I'd love, if you don't mind sharing, you know, can you tell us a little bit about some of the lower points in your life and how you pulled out of them? And, you know, more importantly, what are the takeaways for people listening?
Yeah. So depression completely sucks.
Yeah.
And if anybody's suffering from depression, I just want to take this moment to say, I am so sorry that that is happening, because it's really, really miserable. I have always had depression, but when I was a kid, childhood depression didn't exist, especially not in nice white middle-class families, but it didn't exist anywhere. I mean, there was just no such thing. I was just weird and sad. And I was, it was quite a long time into my adulthood before I realized that what I had was depression. And it was really, a friend of mine recommended the book, The Noonday Demon by Andrew Solomon, which again, if you have not read, is a masterpiece. Not only is it an incredible piece of writing and research, but just the best book I've ever read about depression. And it was such an incredible relief to me to read it and be like, oh my gosh, this is a thing. Like, I'm not crazy. I'm sick. You know? It was a real relief. I know some people don't like to medicalize their depression, but for me, it was a real relief. I have what's called atypical depression, which is sort of a misnomer because it's very typical. But what that means is when I'm out in public, I sort of seem fine. It's very high functioning. So it's not the kind of like lay in bed and cry all day, mm-hmm. can't get up kind of depression. Which, while horrible, has a little advantage in that because other people notice. With atypical depression, it's very easy for other people to not notice. And it's only really when you're alone that the walls really close in. So it's sort of got a little double dose of loneliness. Yeah, and there were times it was really intolerable. It's a really nasty disease. And so what helped me was, you know, it's a global disease, right? It's a chemical problem. It's a spiritual problem. It's a psychic problem. It's an emotional problem. It's a historical problem. It's, you know, it's a hormonal problem. It's everything. So you kind of have to attack it on all fronts. And so for me, Wellbutrin 300 XL absolutely made a difference. Really put a basement on the house. Like, it's not like happy pills. It doesn't, you know, numb you to your feelings or anything, or it doesn't me. It just means that when things do get bad, they don't get as bad. Mm-hmm. And what else? A lot of prayer and meditation. The work of Byron Katie really helped me. Absolutely saved my life. The work of Byron Katie. Which is kind of an evolved version of cognitive behavioral therapy. But it comes and goes. I mean, it still comes back every now and again. I wrote the last time it came back, I was shocked at how sort of quickly it pulled me down and how bad it was. And then I was so relieved when it lifted. I wrote a little post about it on Facebook that got more likes and comments and shares than anything I've ever written by a factor of about 10, which tells me that people are really starved to talk about this disease and they don't have the language. They don't know.
You know, I think you brought up a lot of really interesting points. One is you mentioned medication, which I think, you know, I think the sort of new agey life coachy self-help mantra is you should avoid it at all costs.
Oh, fuck that. Yeah.
And I think that's total bullshit. Having tried to do it. And I remember one of my friends said, he's like, you're white knuckling. I said, what does that mean? He said, you're hanging on by a thin thread. He said, all it's going to take is one little thing to basically push you over the edge.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's stupid. You know, I mean, it's, you wouldn't say don't take medicine if you were diabetic.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say don't take medicine. You know, if you can do it without medicine, sure, of course. But, and I was absolutely one of those people. Oh, I would never take a pill every day. Mm. You know, like, I would punch you if you got in between me and my pill every day.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. A friend of mine told me that when he went to see his doctor, he was like, just think of it as a vitamin for your brain.
That's right.
I was like, okay, cool. I can get on board with that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So let's start talking about this toolkit that lifted you from depression to, you know, six figures on the beach, because I think that's really, you know, in my mind, I don't think it's not necessarily just the money, but sort of the satisfaction that comes from getting to do something you love, being where you want. Like, what is the toolkit? You know, what are aspects and elements of it?
Yeah. So one is embedded in the title of the book. Start right where you are. Quit locating your happiness in the future. Right. Because I was absolutely guilty of that. I was like, okay, if I just get this gig, you know, then it'll be okay. If I book this part, it'll be okay. If I make this money, if I lose this weight, if I that, like, then it'll be okay. And, you know, sometimes I would hit those goals and sometimes I wouldn't. And it didn't make any difference how I was feeling on the inside. So what I realized is you've got to remove your attention from those future things and bring your energy and focus back to the present moment, because that's where all the power is and that's where all the opportunity is. So that means we're spending most of our time managing mindset, managing what's happening inside your head and what your hands and feet can touch right now. Like, what's really in your sphere of influence right now that you can do, and not later today, right now, right now, right now. Mm-hmm. So some of that is just pure straight up well-being stuff, breathing, being fed, you know, doing the halt check, you know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, thirsty, you know, are you any of these things? If so, you must deal with that first. And this idea that people have of like, oh, I can't, you know, I don't have time for my prayer practice, or I don't have time for this because that's selfish. That's selfish. It'd be selfish of me to do that. It's like, no. You walking around exhausted and stressed out and with no sense of humor is what's selfish, because the rest of us have to deal with you like that. And that's not fun. You know, when you are rested and fed and meditated and patted and walked and creatively fulfilled and cuddled, you're great. We love that version of you. You know, you've got a light in your eyes and you can listen and you have good ideas. You're not so reactive. You don't take everything so personally. Can you imagine if everybody showed up like that? Amazing. So, and that's really something that came out of my acting. Like, I would, on the days that I had auditions, I was really careful with myself. You know, I would work out, I'd meditate, I'd make sure I look good, I'd schedule something nice for after the audition so I had something to look forward to. I would not answer the phone so I didn't get pulled off in anybody else's drama. I would really try to be very attentive to the people in the waiting room and everybody I met, and really feeling like everything that was happening was a gift and an opportunity. And then I was like, wait, why am I not doing this all the time? Like, why is this only happening 3 times a week? Like, this could be my whole life. So that's step one, is just really starting from the center out and paying attention to that.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by HostGator. So maybe you're thinking about starting some sort of creative project and you have no idea where to start. And sometimes starting really small is the best thing you can do. In fact, maybe if you do one small thing every single day for 30 days, you'll be amazed by the progress you're making. That's how we actually approach many of our projects. That's how I write books. That's how we build websites. That's how we do just about everything that we do here at Unmistakable Creative. And that's how you should approach building a website. Unfortunately, our friends at HostGator are fantastic for helping you to get started, because they're providing 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. They have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email, a website builder that's easy to use if you're not tech savvy, and one-click WordPress installs if you want to get your hands dirty. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Yeah, it's interesting to hear you sort of talk about that first step, and it makes me think a lot about something that we've been, you know, talking quite a bit about on the show, and, you know, even in our email newsletters, is the idea of designing the environments in your life. And, you know, I just finished watching the Minimalism documentary last night, which features, you know, a ton of former Unmistakable Creative guests. You know, it was really neat to see all these people that we'd interviewed. And, you know, for the longest time, I was under the impression that minimalism was just about, you know, the number of things you own or fitting your life into a backpack. And what I realized is that the message really was not about the number of things that you own, but to be deliberate about what you do own. And by, you know, changing the smallest thing in our environment, like, for example, the shoes you wear, you suddenly show yourself, wait a minute, there's an aspect of reality that I have complete control over that can be actually molded to my own liking. And I started to think, I'm like, wow, if you did that constantly throughout your life, almost everything would be there because you intended for it to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the ways to make sure that you end up inside a happy future. And it kind of loops back to that thing of like, what do you tell your kids? You know, if you are really following your intuition and following your own desire and taking steps and paying attention, not only do you get to enjoy the process of what's unfolding, but it will automatically, I mean, by definition, it will take you someplace cool. It will take you to the place that you will like. You know, you will not end up, you know, lonely in a mansion on the hill, you know, or alone and lonely with 13 cats. You will, you know, as opposed to chasing one of those exterior outside future goals, which you may not like it when you get there. So yeah, exerting as much control as you possibly can over what's happening right now and over the things over which you have control. And I think that's a big mistake people make is we spend way too much time wringing our hands over the things over which we have no control and not nearly enough time exerting control over that over which we do have control. And it's sort of just being a really good parent to yourself.
Yeah.
And then really adjusting your mindset, probably one of the more radical ideas in the book, one of the ones that's helped me the most, is this idea that nothing bad is happening. Nothing bad is happening. I say this all the time, and now my team says it all the time, and now my clients say it all the time, and people say it back to me all the time. Nothing bad is happening. And when I say nothing bad is happening, here's what happens for me. First of all, it reminds me that I have a spiritual belief that says we live in a benevolent universe and not just when things are going my way. So sort of checks me on that. It also makes me get a little more precise in my language. So if nothing bad is happening, what is happening? Is something heartbreaking happening? Is something uncomfortable happening? Is something that is just not the way I would have planned it to go this way happening? Like, what's happening? And then finally, the sort of advanced class is then what is the invitation and the opportunity in what's happening? Because every single thing that looks like a problem or looks like a mistake is calling you forward. It's an opportunity for you to what? To be more tender, to be more understanding, to be firmer, to be bolder, to be a better communicator, a better leader, a better teacher, a better boss, a better woman, a better partner, a better what? You know, like where's the invitation here? And how can you make the most of that?
So, you know, I understand this intellectually, and you can sell me on it right now. Like, I am totally on board. If you had tried to sell me on this idea in 2014, when I was in the midst of like really crippling depression, I feel like no matter how many times I would say, no, nothing bad is happening, all I would be thinking about is all the horrible things that were happening.
Yeah.
And I am curious what you have to say about that, because I'd imagine somebody is out there thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah. So, well, that's one of the hallmarks for me of depression, is that everything bad is happening.
Yeah.
And everything that is happening is bad. It's how I know. It's how I can tell the difference between just a crappy mood and depression. Because when you're just having a crappy mood and you do the things that people always say to do when you have a crappy mood, like go for a walk, talk to a friend, get something to eat, get a massage. Like if I do those things, then I will feel better. Mm-hmm. And if I can shift the mood by doing one of those things, I know, okay, this is just a mood. You know, it's a crappy mood and that's fine. I feel sad. That's fine. It's a crappy mood. When I do those, but when I'm depressed, I can take a walk, I can talk to a friend, I can eat a meal, and it doesn't make any difference. And that, what they call anhedonia, the inability to take pleasure in anything, is for me one of the real signs of depression. Like I'll be sitting there at lunch with a friend going, this is fun. I can tell that it's fun because other people are smiling and laughing. Yeah. Why am I not having the sensation of fun? So yeah, if you're having that experience, then yeah, you have a medical situation that needs immediate attention because it is a fatal disease. Gone untended, it is a fatal disease. And this is why it's a fatal disease, because you feel like nothing will ever get better. It's not that you can't take the pain. We can take the pain. We take the pain all the time. It's when you feel like the pain will never, ever, 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 ever end, no matter what happens. Mm-hmm. That's when you start looking for the exit door.
Yeah, I've... I've been there. I mean, I think it was a surf session with my business partner, Brian. He said, we surfed for 4 hours. He caught wave after wave. And I knew normally in a situation like that, I would be out of the water with a shit eating grin on my face. Yeah. And there's a picture of the two of us on the beach in which I look emaciated. And he said, you're not even smiling in this picture.
Yeah.
And so he knew something was wrong at that point. But you know, one of the things that's interesting is you mentioned sort of this regiment that you follow. And I can relate to this because this is something I do anytime I know I have a speaking engagement coming up, is the 2 weeks before the speaking gig, I am like a athlete training for a game. And I learned that from Eric Wall. I figured based on what Eric Wall's keynote fee was, I was like, okay, I think you might know a thing or two about this. And I am blown away by how effective it is. Like, I don't drink for the 2 weeks before. Exercise is like, at an all-time high. I'm pretty much like an athlete training for a game. And I am blown away by how wonderfully well that works. And I think it's one of those really wonderful hacks that you can apply to nearly every creative project.
Yeah. 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 It's amazing how well good preparation can help. How much it can help. Yeah.
So we've kind of looked at this, I think, to sort of a holistic lens and at a higher level. So let's get more granular with this idea of starting right where we're at. I mean, what on a day-to-day basis, in addition to some of what you've talked about, can people be doing to move, whatever it is they're trying to move forward?
Yeah. So one of them is just a little breathing technique that I learned 150 years ago that I love. And we can actually just do it right now. Should we just do it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll inhale for 4, hold for 7, exhale for 8. I'll count us through it and we'll just do it one time.
Okay.
So let your belly go really poochy soft and give yourself a little Mona Lisa smile. And inhale 2, 3, 4, hold 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, exhale 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Thank you. Thank you for doing that with me. And that's what it makes me do. Doing that breathing makes me go, And you can do it one time. You can do it 3 times. You can do it 10 times. You can do it all night long. It works in the parking lot of the Trader Joe's. It works during divorce proceedings. It works during medical procedures. It works. I have friends who have insomnia. They say it's great for insomnia. So that's, again, super duper simple, tiny. And this is the whole thing with the book, right? It's 66 super tiny, tiny, tiny little chapters. And each one has a little tiny action step. And most of them are as simple as that. Just breathe. Just be present in your body for 1 second. See how that changes things.
So, I think you pointed out something really interesting. You said most of these are very tiny, simple things. I feel like we all know so much about what we need to do in order to change whatever we want to change, but doing it is really where the trouble seems to occur.
Yeah, you know what, Srini, you have just underlined one of my favorite flags with a client. Because I hear this from people all the time. I know what I need to do. I just need to make myself do it. Right? I know what I need to do. I just need to make myself do it. Whenever I hear that, I immediately call bullshit. Because what that really means is you know one way to do it and you don't want to do it that way. Because if you knew, if it were the way to do it, then you would already be doing it. Look at all the things you've done. People do things all the time. You're very good at doing things. Like, the reason you're not, I've got to work out. I should go, I got to go to the gym. I know I got to go to the gym. I just need to make myself do it. No, if going to the gym were the answer, you would already be going to the gym. So clearly that's not your bag. Let it go. Think of something else. Like, figure out another way, because there is some other way to get you to the result you want. I mean, first of all, you can question whether or not you actually need to work out. Do you actually want that result? Maybe it's just a big should that you have sitting on your head that's making you miserable. Some things you can just cross off the list. Some things you're not doing because you genuinely don't give a shit. So just like, you know what? I don't give a shit about this. Let's just cross it off the list. But if it's something you really do care about, then start looking more at the things that you are doing. You know, what are your own natural creative rhythms? What are the things you already love to do? What are the things that you do so easily and effortlessly, you know, you don't even notice that you're doing them practically? There's a way to get that result doing it your way, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's again, part of that, the joy of bringing it back to you, you're present right now, who you are right now, and what's happening right now, as opposed to some fantasy future self that somehow, you know, manages to go to the gym every day and have a sparkling smile and I don't know, whatever else that person does. And it's tiny, tiny shifts, little one degree shifts. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's it.
You know, I think that we have a tendency in our culture to underestimate the impact of tiny shifts because we don't see the result from them like immediately. Whereas, you know, you kind of add those things up over the course of, you know, a month, a year, you know, 3 years, it's kind of remarkable what a difference they make.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, the thing that just popped into my head is, you know, we always hear about lottery winners who win the lottery and then 5 years later, they're exactly back to where they started economically. You know, when those big giant changes happen, if we're not ready for them, it's just not going to make any difference. So on the other hand, if you spent those years making little tiny 1 degree shifts in how you manage your money, you could have that lottery money in 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. So I have another tool actually that's sort of on my mind to share. That's kind of one of my favorites. It's a little like picking your favorite child, 66 exercises. This one's my favorite. But it's especially good for when you're stuck, when you've got that, like, I can't figure out what to do, or you're stuck in a feeling, you know, like you're mad, you know, you shouldn't be mad, but you're mad, or you're sad, or you're trapped in an old story, like something happened in your past that you sort of can't get over. This is a really effective technique. Make some 5 minute art about it. Make some 5 minute art about it. So that means you maybe draw a picture, and maybe it's just stick figures or just colors. Just how does it feel? What is the feeling of this? Or maybe you do a dance, or maybe you make up a little song, or you get out the Sculpey clay, or I don't know, whatever it is, however it is you like to express yourself. But make some 5 minute art about it. And what happens is two things happen. One, feelings just want to be felt. Feelings just want to be felt. That's all they want. And once a feeling knows it's been felt, it can get a promotion and get a better job. As opposed to like trying to keep the feelings locked away, because that strategy works so very well. Said no one ever. So feelings just want to be felt. But also, once you have let your feelings take form, you can start to interact with them in a different way. You can start to have a different perspective on them. When it's all happening inside of your head, it feels really confusing and hard and often kind of dark. But once it's out in a song, in a dance, on a piece of paper, you can get a different perspective. And you know, so you're talking about not really noticing how depressed you were. I was working with a client one time on some money stuff, and she made it, but she started to get really upset. So I said, okay, go make some art about it. And she came back with this drawing of a big black bird that took up like the entire page. And she's like, I had no idea how angry I was about this situation. Like, until I saw the drawing of the big black bird, I did not realize that I was really this mad. It's like, excellent. Now we can deal with the mad. Like, that's something we can handle. It's a really astonishing little game.
Wow. This has been really, really, really insightful. I love conversations like this. So I want to finish with one last question, which is how we finish all our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's when somebody allows themselves to be their own tuning fork. You know, when you really pay attention to that inner gong and you let what resonates with you affect you, and you let your tone, your vibration affect others, Yeah, that's what it is. That's the image that's coming to my mind is a tuning fork that when you're just right in vibe with your own self, with your own music, with your own tone.
Well, this has been fantastic. Where can people learn more about you, your work, and the book?
The book, you can go to startrightwhereyouare.com, startrightwhereyouare.com. And there's a super fun little freebie opt-in there. And then you can get on my email list, which is mostly how I communicate with people. You can write me back. We'll be pen pals, best friends. It'll be great. Start Right Where You Are, or theorganizedartistcompany.com is the other place you can find me.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
Nobody ever started with you and said, look, there's two games. There's this social game, but there's this other thing over here called the universe, you know, your inner self, your authentic self. And you have to figure out, how do I put myself in this game, the social game, and still value my inner self and do what drives me without doing what I need to do to get the attention of the external world? Because listen, when we're born as babies, that we survive because we become masters at getting other people's attention and approval, period, right? If we don't cry, if we don't coo, if we don't whatever, we're not going to eat. We're not going to get a blanket put on us. So we're driven from that point on to worry about the external world, what they're thinking and how they're feeling about us. Nobody ever says to you, hold on a minute. You know, we're not living in the jungle. We don't have to survive that way anymore. We're living in a modern world. And you have to look at what drives you if you want to have a fulfilled life and focus on that. And yes, understand how the external world works, but don't let that thing grab onto you and drag you along, because you'll wake up someday and you'll say, holy, I never lived.
Tom Asacker joins us to talk about the business of belief.